now more than ever, people need to go within and plug into that cellular memory, plug into divine source, detach as much as possible from the matrix.
Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Today, our very special guest is Paul Sinclair. Paul Sinclair returns to the Cosmic Switchboard Show to talk about things going on in the Bempton, Yorkshire area, to talk about some interesting developments in the field. The website is truthproof.webs.com. And without any further ado, Paul Sinclair, welcome back to the Cosmic Switchboard Show.
James, thank you very much for allowing me to come back. And yeah, as you said before, the research is pretty much ongoing. It never seems to stop. You know, we're in a little bit of a flat moment period at the moment. But having said that, because of the popularity of the books, it's now got people from all over the UK traveling to Eastern North Yorkshire.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and they are reporting, because they're not just there. Obviously, sometimes they want to meet me. I'm meeting some guys up there on Friday, all being well, time allowing, and they're staying all night. But these people, these strangers, for want of a better word, who've purchased the books, some of them have had experiences up there, and they're sort of reporting this stuff's still happening. Last time we spoke, I think I told you about the animal mutilations in the area.
Yes.
Obviously, once the nutrition goes out of the land, out of the grass, the livestock get removed. So they did. I think it was the 6th of April. The 6th of December 2018. But they're back. They came back in April. And I actually found the first casualty, shall we say, last Saturday morning. I should have gone up a few days before, or maybe 4 days before, but there's an animal anyway, a sheep. But all that was left of this animal was the fleece and its head. I'm sorry to sound so graphic, listeners, but that's it, what it is. The face was stripped. The carcass hadn't been there long because it would have smelt, as I'm sure everybody would realize. Earlier in the year, when the sheep weren't there, I did go up, obviously not as frequently, and I found two roe deer. Once again, I got to them after the event. And I'm pretty sure they hadn't been poached because all the skeletal remains were there and the hide. But once again, the facial area had been stripped, but everything had gone other than that, you know, the meat and the sort of prime organs had gone. So this is still happening. We're no closer to finding out what is responsible for doing it. Because if these carcasses, James, or these unfortunate animals aren't found fairly quickly by myself, other predators or natural scavengers in the area, you know, crows, rooks, badgers, fox, they get to it and they'll soon deplete it. And, you know, there's no shortage of them, but whatever's doing the initial killing is, and I know this for a fact with all the photographic evidence that I've taken, it's stripping the face in most cases, removing the ears, and it's actually, we can say it's surgical precision how it's removing the ears. They're sliced, and there's no blood. No blood on the cuts of the ears. The eyes look like they've been taken out with a Hoover. That's just the best analogy I can give you, because there's no trauma that shows anything's tried to get at these eyes. So it's pretty horrific. So yeah, that's still happening. I hope it's not going to be a repeat performance of the last 2 or 3 years. And remember, I've only jumped into the animal mutilation part of it quite recently. We've been spending time in this affected area trying to film the light forms, trying to document all the other stuff that's been happening. And quite, as I told you last time, quite unknown to me, this animal mutilation was taking place. My gut feeling is it's not a predator, be it even a big cat that's not native to the UK, because it's not eating its victims. I'm finding these animals, or I was last year, straight after they've been killed, very soon after they've been killed. You know, I'm getting up there just as it's getting light, and you'll find one. And I don't mean there's hundreds, that'd be a lie, but there's far too many for it to be anything normal. But jumping from that in a similar area, James, me and Christopher Turner, we're making a documentary called Bringing Down the Light, which is documenting all this unexplained phenomena, which definitely will be out this year. We've got first-hand witnesses who've sat in front of the camera and related their experiences diverse as looking at the light forms and having some kind of interaction with them. An ex-military man who saw a huge bullet-shaped object above the old RAF base, where a lot of the phenomena is reported, very close to RAF Bempton, which is now closed, listeners. For anybody in the UK, you'll not get onto that base. I need to stress that. And to something as diverse as a demon, the guy claims that he'd seen a demon with his wife at a place called Caton, about 11 miles away. But to jump to the cliff tops and in close proximity to where these animals are being killed, we did a bit of a night visual up there approximately 2 months ago. And there was a rock angler. You could see him in the distance. And I've explained before that these cliffs range from 200 to 400 feet, and the sheer drops. And these guys fish from the top of them and actually catch cod and all sorts of other fish and pull them up this great sort of drop. But anyway, nighttime, he's walking back along the cliffs. I put a torch on because I didn't want to alarm him in the darkness. He asked us what we were doing. So we sort of told him we were after filming these lights. And he's quite amiable. He said to me, well, and I was with Bob Brown, the talk show guy. He were with me this particular night. He says to me, well, I've fished these cliff tops now for almost 50 years from man and boy. He said, and I've seen all sorts of strange things, including strange goings on around the former RAF Bempton, where I've spoke before about the alleged satanic cult. We've gone from alleged now, James. It's real. The first book touched on it being an alleged satanic cult because I didn't have enough information. The second book ventured a little bit deeper. And the third book, which is due out shortly, will be talking about the cult. And I've got to be a little bit guarded because I've already been warned. I've been threatened about that, but I'll get to that in a moment. The rock angler said to us, we were on a fishing match one night, and he says, and I can even tell you the year, and we filmed him. He's allowed us to film him. We went up a few days later, put lights on him. He says, I can even tell you the year, and it was 1998, and it was November. He said, and it was a club match. He says, so there's quite a lot of guys fishing on the cliff tops. Now, listeners, you've got to understand that these cliff tops, we're talking 3 or 4 miles, so these guys don't get close together. You'll just see lights in the distance. Could be half a mile apart, could be quarter of a mile apart, just depending where they favour to fish. He says, I turned round, and he pointed to the hill, very close to where we were observing, trying to film the lights. He said, I turned round and looked in the distance. He says, and I thought, Christ, what's that? He swore, actually. He said, Christ, what's that? He said, between the land and obviously you've got the sky above, there was a slightly lighter band of sky, but it's still nighttime. He says, and at first I thought, what's a combined harvester doing up there in November? He says, and a few other guys, you could see their headlights bobbing about and moving. They'd all seen it as well. He said, because suddenly I realised it was 30 to 40 foot off the ground, totally silent. And this huge thing that he described as big as a double-decker bus, but at first he just thought it was a combined harvester coming over the top of the hill. And we're not talking quarter of a mile away here. We're in close proximity. He said, so this thing's in the sky, 30 to 40 feet up, huge, lights flashing all around it. And it slowly lowered. And as it got close to the ground, he said, sparks came everywhere around the ground, and all the area, the contained area around it, set on fire. He said, with that, packed my fishing gear up and did a runner, as did some of the other rock anglers. Now, I had been told about this story, but we hadn't got a date, James, because I've been told about a rock angler that left all his fishing gear on the cliff top. Such was the fear of seeing this landed object. So not only have we got reports of the mutilated animals and what I consider call the light forms, the intelligent light forms, be these objects. We've got an actual structured object that I'm told landed on the cliff tops. As I say, this guy's allowed us to film him. We put lights on him in the night and in the approximate area, and he told us about it, and he describes it, and he gives us the date and everything. I do realise, James, and I think probably 100% of your listeners realise, that all we are getting here is word of mouth. Obviously, I've got documented proof with the photographs of the mutilation. However, still doesn't tell us what's doing it. But there's another intelligence behind this, in my opinion, that's not of this world, or as we perceive this world. I personally believe it's some kind of interdimensional unknown something, for want of a better word, that's entering our sphere of existence and doing these things and putting on these displays, if we can call them displays, because this phenomena does not perform to order. We can stand on those cliff tops, and I'm repeating myself a little bit here, I should think, to some people, but we can stand there for 6 months and nothing happens. We've got cameras set up, we're ready to go, and then it takes you by surprise. When you're not waiting, when you're not ready for it, when you're walking back, it appears. Which brings me back to the rock angler, which is quite, this is the amazing part of it, is telling us the story from 1998, and we've got the cameras on him. I'm sort of on, you know, in front of him. After we've done the little interview, we pack things away. I think you know what I'm going to say. Two globes of orange light appeared out at sea, which would have been in shot if we'd have just stayed another 10 minutes. From the two globes of orange light, a third one appeared to the left. We got none of it on film. All we've got is the rock angler's word that it happened and Bob Brown's word that it happened. This is a truth, James, that leaves no proof. It's crazy. You know, I don't know. Have you any views on that, James?
Well, they do seem at times to have the ability to know when you're looking at them or know when you're about to start filming them. They can either manifest and allow themselves to be filmed, or conversely, they could pull a disappearing act or do something to mess with the camera gear. So,
yeah, well, obviously, I came away from that, and the rock angler did, the guy who's been there on them cliff tops on and off for 49 years, as he said, and Bob, we came away feeling that was deliberate. I mean, we'd been up there for months and seen nothing, and yes, the day we take this guy up. But if you want me to briefly stay talking about the RAF base and the cult, I mean, are you interested in that?
Yes, please. Whatever you feel is important at this time, please.
Well, you know, like I said, in the first book, we just touched on it, and it was everything I was speaking about, I said alleged. And then the second book, we got a bit deeper. But now, for bringing down the light and for the third book, we've got people who've gone in front of camera and actually told us what they've seen and experienced down there. So I've got a guy there who, as a late teens with friends, went down into the underground bunker, that is RAF Bempton, and they retrieved daggers and hoods and robes. Now, these hoods and robes, they're not just pillowcases. These are really well-made garments, and he's sat there and in front of a camera and said what he's found down there. So that tells us something very real was taking place. There's another guy that I won't say desperate, but very keen to interview, who's already told me the story, but I want him on camera, even if he sits with his back to the camera. And he believes that he got out, I won't say with his life, but he had a narrow escape. He went down there and with some friends, but he was the last one out, sort of thing. And they disturbed some kind of ritual where they were sacrificing animals. So we know, regardless of what anybody wants to say, you know, because people in the village say, oh, it were just rumour, this cult was real. Now, I've also spoken to somebody who's got a bit of involvement with I've got to be really guarded here because I've been warned. If I even come to exposing where they're still operating, people won't be happy with me. Let's put it that way. And this guy says that they were using two books down there, which, books that you'll be familiar with, but perhaps, but not me. And they were using the Black Pullet, and they were using one called the Black Pullet and one called the Key of Solomon. Are you familiar with these books, James?
I've heard of the Key of Solomon. I'm not familiar with the other one.
Yeah, well, they were talking about they'd made the book out of skin, not human skin, animal skin. And you stop me, James, if you'd rather I don't talk about this. They'd made this book, the Black Pullet, out of skin, of a goat skin. Okay. The outer cover and the pages, and they'd written with its blood incantations, so I'm told, and they were trying to summon demons. Now, there's truth attached to this now with the two witnesses that I've got who spoke about, one, what they've witnessed, and two, the actual garments that they've taken out of the bunker. And I'll probably have pictures of the garment, because he's still got the hood. But that's where we were with the satanic cult, and that sort of, it's not to dispel the rumors or anything now, because I think everybody in the locality, if you speak to them about RAF Bempton, they'll say, oh, they were devil worshippers at RAF Bempton, or oh, there were witchcraft going off at RAF Bempton. Nobody seems to actually, until now, nobody's actually been able to put a finger on it and say, is it rumor, or was this actually happening? But I believe it was. That's where I'm at the moment with it. But, you know, the research is ongoing. I'm looking at an amazing case at the moment, James. It hasn't got a name as such, but about 6 or 7 miles from where I'm sat now in Bridlington is a small village called Hunnamby. We have spoke about it before when we talked about the Flixton werewolf, because it's very close to Flixton. And Hunnamby means Hundman, and the actual name of the village in ancient times was Farmstead of the Houndman, or not name of the village. It was called Hunbanby. Hund as in dog, man. Farmstead of the Hound Man. So I got talking to some guys. One of the men's sons used to work for me when I was a joiner, and he was a labourer, a real nice lad, and he always knew my interest in the unexplained and UFOs, yet he never told me this story. And we've known each other for going on 25 years. This lad, David, they call him, that's his real name. I've been told not to use surnames, but they're okay with first names. And these guys have been doing some work in Flamborough, which is close to Bempton, and a conversation came up with the guy they were doing the work for. I'll try not to labour on here, listeners, but I want to tell you how I got to know the story. And this guy suddenly said, well, you must tell Paul Sinclair. He'll be interested in this. They didn't know that the guy they were talking to knew me. And bearing in mind that these guys only live about 200 yards away from me, and they've never told me the story, or the son never relayed it to me when he worked for me, and his dad's never said. So anyway, basically I found out, and I asked them if they'd tell me about it, and they agreed. And this is how the Rock Anglers story came up, and this is how the 1998 ties in. In 1998 at Hunnamby, they worked on a small industrial unit, and we're talking small, probably about 11 units. Big enough to drive a bus in, though, because these guys used to do spraying and sign writing, and they used to do fairground rides and all sorts. And it's a strange story. So they started working there in 1996, 97, and 98. And I've spoke to all three men, and they've not seen each other for years, and they're all singing roughly off the same page. So in 1996, they started working at this unit, and this was a second job that these men were doing. So they did their day job, they came home, had a bite to eat, and then they drove the 6 or 7 miles from Bridlington to Hunnamby, and then worked during the night, sometimes till 2 and 3 in the morning, go home, get a bit of kip, a bit of sleep, and go back to the day job. And they did this for 3 years. He said it started in June. And Andrew told me this. It was Andrew first relayed the story. Then he put me in touch with the other two. He says, I'm in the unit working on a vehicle that's in there. He can't remember which type. He says, and in the bottom right-hand corner, there's a toilet block. And above the toilet block, there's the boss's office. He went up some stairs to it. And above that, there's a dark space where things were stored. And prior to them taking over the unit, it was a workshop, engineering workshop. He says, so there was boxes of washers and nuts and bolts all over and bits and bats. He said, I'm just working there in June, and they've dated it, James, by music, believe it or not, because
I've done that too.
Yeah. So they're talking about the Spice Girls. That's what they've racked their brains and got me some closer dates now. But originally they were doing it by music. Oh, that were in the charts. He said, I'm on my own at this time. He says, and suddenly a piece of wood flew straight past my head. He says, and I looked. He says, and then I heard a ping on the corrugate, on the unit sides. And bear in mind, you could get plenty of vehicles in it. It was your big roller shutter doors where you could drive a bus in and drive it out the other end. He says, and a big, like a ping, he says, and I weren't aware of what had happened. And I'm thinking, somebody's enacting about. He says, and I felt like it came from the dark space above the office. He says, I kept my eyes on it. Then I heard another ping. He says, and then suddenly the boss and the other lad they worked with, Dave, arrived. And this, he says, and I said, oh, you're here. He said, there's something happening. There's something strange happening. He said, there's somebody in here, I think. So they got some ladders and sort of looked over the dark area, and there was nothing at all. And then all of a sudden, a steel washer hit the side of the unit. And then another one hit the side of the unit. And they said this slowly built up throughout June, July and August. He says, all sorts would happen. Suddenly the radio would go very loud and a bulb would pop, and which would trip all the power, including the sockets, and the radio would carry on playing. He said, we were in there one day doing an MG Roadster. Do you remember what car it was? He said, the keys were in the ignition and the car started. He says, and there's only three of us in there. He says, and we can't believe it. It's just started up. Chris, who was the guy they worked for, went to the Roadster and turned the ignition key and took the keys out. It carried on running. They pulled the bonnet and did something and managed to stop the car. Now, you're wondering where we're going with this, James, but it's an incredible story, if you're still sufficiently interested, James.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the fact that he turned the ignition all the way to the left and it still was running, I mean...
Yeah, he said we got an auto electrician in and told him there was a massive problem with car and this had happened, and he just laughed at us. He said, there was a caravan out back and a guy used to stay in it. He said, and there'd be other vehicles in the back compound, which we... were getting ready to work on, or we had worked on. He says, and a regular occurrence during June, July and August, when we got to work, this guy was absolutely shouting at us and furious because the car horns would suddenly start going off. This was 1998. We didn't have fancy alarms in that time. It was just like somebody's pressing the horn of the car. The car radios used to come on. So he said, we just sort of accepted it. We just sort of absorbed it, he said, because it just come on so gradual. He said, they were working on an open-topped bus inside the unit one night, and suddenly the radio went up right loud, which is plugged in. A light fitting dropped into the top of the open-topped bus, which I suppose everybody can think, well, yes, accidents and things do happen. He said, no, the power went off, but the radio carried on playing. He said, so we just couldn't understand it. He says, and then Chris, our boss, decided to let part of the compound out at the back to a guy who wanted to break up caravans and sell parts. And during the clearing of the land, they found a small grave, a wooden grave marker from the 1800s. And it turns out it was a little girl, the inscription on it. They don't remember what the name was or anything now. But they believed it was poltergeist activity. He says the washers were pinging off the sides of the building. It just became normal practice. He said, but we never saw anything drop from the building. He said, suddenly, an handful of stones would fall in front of us and land on the floor inside the building, like gravel. Or an empty jar would just drop behind us and smash. He said, sometimes we were all together and these things were happening. It wasn't somebody just acting about. And all these things continued to happen. And then they just, after they'd found the grave marker, they decided amongst themselves that it was some kind of poltergeist activity. Whether it was or not, I can't say. But on top of this, most evenings of the week when they were working, Dave, who was the youngest of the three men, his mum and dad used to run through. I'm not sure whether they brought him a flask or sandwiches. I don't know. But they'd come through from Bridlington and spend a few hours. So they witnessed all this as well. So my point now getting at is this particular night in August, March, June, July, August 1998, they stood in the back compound outside and they can see three distinct dark shapes in the sky coming in from the sea. And they carried on watching them and there's no lights on them and it's just three monstrously huge triangles, black triangles, totally silent, coming towards them. And I think there were some lorry drivers from another unit watching these triangles as well. And they were convinced that they were going to go right over the top of them. They were going to get an absolute bird's eye view of these triangles that were just absolutely enormous. That's how they describe them. No sound, no lights, as we people describe seeing a light on each corner, no lights. He said, but before they could get over the top of them, these things just switched off. These things, he said, they didn't fly away. These things just ceased to exist. So that was the night before what we would call the event. So they're in the compound. They're working during the night. And Dave's mum and dad have come to visit. And they set off. We'll call it 11 o'clock. They set off quite late to go back to Bridlington. A short time later, they came back. Mum's crying. Dad's very upset and nervous, frightened, in fact. And they'd been stopped on the road between Humanby and Bridlington. There's an army roadblock. And they've been dragged into the back of a vehicle. And they've let me record this, by the way. It's not just sort of word of mouth. They've been dragged into the back of the vehicle and there's military personnel inside with guns, not in camouflage gear, in black from head to toe, threatening them not to go back to Bridlington, to get back to the workshop, so they knew all about it, get back into that workshop, do not move. I can't, this is one part of it, James, I don't understand why they didn't just let them just drive back to Bridlington and be totally unaware. But this is what I'm told happened. So they went back to the unit. They told the guys in the unit, and the roller shutters at some point went up about 6 or 8 foot at the back of the unit. And at the bottom of the compound, Dave and Andrew were stood together and the parents were there, you know, Dave's parents. And Andrew says, all I can describe it as is a classic 1950s UFO. And I can see it in the bottom of the compound surrounded by mist and lights. He said, and there's a glass bubble on the top. He says, and I can see this thing inside it. And they say a thing, because I said, hey, what was it, an alien? He said, I don't know. I said, I could just see this thing inside it. He says, and it was surreal. It was like watching a movie set. He said, I just couldn't believe it. And he said, then there's some kind of, I don't know whether there's missing time between guys. I haven't deciphered this yet, but they don't recall being with each other after that, because Andrew says that he stepped outside to get a closer look. And the next thing is dragged in by two soldiers with guns. I'll not swear, but he said they were real nasty men. He said they warned me, get inside, keep your mouth shut, stay there. He says there was helicopters everywhere. He says, but this on the deck, this landed thing was not a helicopter. It was a classic, as he says, 1950s looking UFO. Says that's as much as I can say. So I spoke to Dave at length, face to face, not on the phone or anything. And he tells the same story. And he's dragged in, he's taken away and warned by the soldiers to stay, to keep put. His mum and dad had already had the warning. But Dave's version is slightly different. He can remember looking down the compound and seeing this thing, as he says, surrounded by mist and lights and the shape, about as big as a flatback truck, he said, circular in shape. But he saw two beings stood outside it, slightly forward. And he's 6 foot, is Dave. And he thinks these things would have been 7 to 8 foot tall. And he couldn't decipher any eyes or any colour. All he could see was the black outline. He said, and if they'd got clothing on, they must have had wetsuits on. He says, because they were really thin, and I'm trying to, well, I think the listener can picture what I'm saying. Their heads were slightly larger than the bodies in comparison to the body, and these things were really tall and thin. Now, I spoke to Chris, the boss. He saw one being outside the object, and he's more vague than the other two, because he said, I didn't see its head and shoulders. Now, I don't know whether that's because of mist. He says, but it was very tall, whatever it was, up to, you know, chest height. He says, it was so tall. He said, yeah, he says, I do recall the thing, the landed thing in the compound, but I can't tell you any more than that. He said, the soldier that he encountered had a machine gun. So I think, unless these men are lying, and they've sat on this story, James, now for, well, 20-odd years, haven't they? And they didn't want to talk about it. I mean, I pulled the story out of Andrew simply because he lives quite close to me, and that's how secretive they've been about it. He's never told me. Then he contacted the other two. One of them agreed to talk to me, and I went and we had a real lengthy conversation. The other one didn't want to talk to me because it brought up on so much stress in his mind. If you would have heard that initial phone call when I rang this guy, I swear to you, I've spoke to him face to face since, you'd have thought I'd have hit him in the face with a shovel, because I'll give a brief example. I don't want to bore listeners with this, but I rang up, introduced myself, and he went, oh dear, oh no, I never thought anybody would, oh, shouldn't be talking about this, oh no. And that was the conversation. I've since sat down and had an hour and a half conversation with him, and I'm going to have another one. But it's painful for this guy to... I think more happened, and I have said that to him, and I think he knows. But obviously, it's up to the witness. It's up to them. I can't force anybody to tell me anything. I think he's probably only telling me what he needs to tell me, because he knows that I've got a large chunk of this story from the other two witnesses. Otherwise, I don't think he would have ever spoken to me. They've got my word that I would never reveal their surnames or anything like that, and that's a given. But I think you can see there, James, that the story is quite, I think it's incredible so far anyway.
Yes, we're talking about landed craft with some eerie mist around it, reminiscent of Bentwaters, actually, that story.
Yep.
And then we have two separate individuals describing occupants or beings that had alighted from the craft. How close did they get to the beings?
I would have thought they'd have been about 50 foot away.
Crikey.
Yeah, but what's interesting also, James, is how did the military know?
Yes.
A roadblock set up midway. I mean, I've via social media, anybody who wanted to look, there's a, I think it's called Hum and Be Now. You'll see that I've written a few paragraphs and put it on there. I'm after witnesses who can confirm the roadblock. They don't have to confirm seeing a UFO or triangles. Any information is valid. Somebody must remember that roadblock. He's got to have. It wouldn't have just been set up for Dave's mum and dad, surely. So I'm looking for witnesses who can remember this roadblock or any information to sort of pack some more meat around this story, because I believe it because of the integrity of Andrew, because I've known him a long time, and he sat on the story, and he literally lives 100 yards away from my home, and he's never told me. And I don't think he would have done it. It was just a mistake by talking about it to somebody else whilst on a job. It's not that he doesn't trust me. It really affected them. Whatever happened really affected these guys. I mean, Dave came out with an interesting one, the youngest, the one whose mum and dad used to visit. He said, I'll tell you something else, Paul. He said, not all the time. He says, but on the journey from Bridlington to Humumby to do our work, our night shift work there, I can remember setting off. He said, there's only a few occasions this happened. This is in the three-year period, but I can remember setting off, and suddenly I remember driving back home. But I can't remember ever getting there, and I can't remember doing any work. And he said, I just, these blank periods have really sort of frustrated and puzzled me over the years, because I have got vivid recollection of driving back to Bridlington and thinking, I don't remember getting there, and I don't remember coming doing any work. What's happened? He said, and during that time, sometimes on the journeys home, and Andrew's backed this up, and Chris, and usually in the early hours, there'd be a huge flash of light where everything would become daylight. And Dave seems to think that this is when he's had these blank periods.
He may have had missing time abduction experiences prior to that main event.
Prior to the main event. But then, James, we've got to ask, what was all this activity that was taking place in the three-year build-up to this? I mean, they also added, and all three of them have said this, there was a calendar on the wall, and whenever they arrived, it was on August. They'd change it, no matter how many times they changed it, this calendar went to August.
That's strange.
He never saw it go to August. Now, Andrew was the most bold of them, shall we put it that way. Towards August 1998, he started getting a bit clever with the phenomena, shall we say. So as this thing's dropping coins from the air, I don't think I mentioned coins, and he said, pesetas, old money, never anything you could spend. He says, now I would shout out, give me something I can spend, or give me the lottery numbers. You're a waste of time. He said, and their boss, Chris, said, which I find quite telling, stop this. You don't know what you're dealing with. You've got to stop. He said, because you shouldn't be messing with this. Like, you do not taunt it. You don't know what you're dealing with. And so Chris remembers saying this. Dave remembers him telling Andrew this, and Andrew remembers being warned. And then this particular night, Andrew said, I'd just been saying, give me something I can spend. Give me something that I can prove that this is happening with. And he said, I just turned round. He said, and almost in slow motion, he says, I could see a coin coming towards me. And it was a UK two pence piece. He said, which will be about 1.5 inch round. He says, and I can see the full circle, not on edge. And it's coming like as you'd look at the sun, a full circle. He says, and it hit me bang in the middle of the forehead. He said, and the other two have laughed. They've told me this story, and Dave's laughed. Andrew sort of laughs now. He says, Dave said, he was spinning round on the floor going, I've been hit, and going round in circles. He says, and we didn't know what had happened at first. He said, when he took his hand away, he'd got a round circular red mark in the middle of his head, which lasted or stayed there for about 3 days. All three of men have said that.
Jeez.
So this thing hit him. Now, that is intense to me, unless all three men are lying, and they've not told anybody else this story, so they're not doing it for sensationalism. So unless all three men are lying, this happened. And so we've got an intelligence behind this. If you want to call it poltergeist activity, then call it poltergeist activity. But I'm inclined to believe that one of those men, that's where I am with this, was somehow creating that energy, that activity. And I have reasons for saying that. I'm inclined to think that one of those men, when I get further into the story, which won't be today, and I've got more information, there's a reason why the military knew. There's a reason why Chris was saying, stop messing, you don't know what you're dealing with. I think he was the focus of all this. And I've said that to him. The other two think it. But he's most affected by it all. And I think this is something that he'd rather forget than remember. But there's a lot more to come with the story. I'm just hoping I can find some more witnesses, James, that are going to step forward and as I said earlier, pack some meat around the bones of what's happening and back these men's words up. Dave's mum and dad are far too ill now to talk about it. Mum knows and she won't talk about it, and dad's ill, so I have to respect that. But the other three, I've got a very similar story of all three men to varying degrees as regards the beings or the occupants of this object that had landed. There was helicopters everywhere. I'm amazed that there's not going to be more witnesses coming forward. I know it's a long time since, but I'm sure somebody will remember, James.
Just a quick question, Paul. Was there any notion, any of them, of how long that craft was on the ground? And just to clarify a point, was that craft on the ground, did that incident happen after they saw the three large triangular-shaped craft in the sky?
Yes, the incident happened after they'd seen the triangular craft. From what I'm gathering, you see, the guys, we're going back 20-odd years, aren't certain, but they think it was the night after.
Oh, okay. The night after they saw the three.
The night after, yeah. But it's odd. I mean, I'd love to say it were a landed triangle, but Andrew's the one that describes the object or got a better view of the object than the others, and he says it was a classic 1950s flying saucer. And I mean, why he would say that and not a triangle? The guy's honest, and he's saying what he saw. He says there were a glass dome on top of like a bubble. He says, and this thing, he didn't call it an alien. He says, I could see it inside it. And he said, a tall, just a dark, spidery outline of this thing inside it. So he didn't see anything outside the object. Dave saw, I think it's two of them. I've got the recordings. And Chris saw one, but he didn't see the full being. For some reason, he didn't see the head, unless he's just saying he didn't see the head. During all this, originally, I think Andrew and David were together. Dave were together. His mum and dad must have been in the unit, and they'd been told already. They'd already had the warning. And I think all the guys knew something was going to happen, because when Dave's mum and dad came back, they were in a right state. Mum crying, dad frightened. But for some reason, Dave and Andrew had been split up. I hope I'm not bamboozling people with names here, listeners. But Chris, they don't recall where Chris was when anything was happening. They don't know where he went. And that's as much as I'll tell you there. That might tell the listener more than what I'm not telling the listener. But they don't know where Chris went when all of this was happening. So Chris is telling the same story as the other two, but I think there's more, and time will tell.
The possibility exists, perhaps, that Chris was taken on board or otherwise at least momentarily taken away.
Well, I think it is a possibility, and it is a strong possibility that one of the men knew a lot more about what was going to happen than the other two.
You already mentioned the one individual who mentioned the missing time episodes in that region. And which person was that?
That was Dave. He said that he remembers driving to Humumbee, but he doesn't remember getting there or doing anything. The next thing he seems to remember is he's on the road back to Bridlington, and he's late.
The classic. Now, did the other two ever mention unusual happenings in their earlier life prior to these big events happening, and what's happened to them, all of them, subsequent to this? So have they had any follow-on experiences? Another question on top of that, they're all tied in. Are they all locals? Have they all grown up in this area?
All three men are from Bridlington, which is approximately 6 to 7 miles away from Humumbee. So, yeah, they're quite local to area. All three men echo the same, that these huge flashes of light. When we say that, I mean, I suppose it's like looking for the light forms. You could go for 6 months and not see anything, and then you'll see one. So they all agree that they can remember these huge flashes of light in the night, usually travelling back to Bridlington, that lit up the sky lit up the land momentarily for a second. I mean, James, what kind of energy could do that?
Yeah, that's pretty eerie. And I've heard similar stories of a craft or an unseen something in the sky lighting up.
Yeah.
Like a large terrain.
If you have any more questions to ask, please do. I know that we didn't plan on talking about this, but I think I've given you the outline of the story so far. I mean, there will be more.
Well, it's got all the elements. You mentioned that there was a military presence. There was a roadblock set up on one of the roads. There were helicopters flying around. Were the helicopters flying around while that saucer was on the ground?
That's the interesting thing, because when they said that they'd seen this object on the ground, they said there was all three have said, and there was helicopters, and they could hear multiple helicopters, but they couldn't see them. And I said, are you sure that this just wasn't an helicopter that's landed in the bottom of the compound? It's definitely not. This thing was round with a bubble on the top, Andrew said. Lights all around it and some weird yellowy-white mist all around the bottom of it. He said, but all three, that's what they've said to me, that which is interesting. They could all hear helicopters but not see them. The military, you know, it must have been some kind of special operations, because the military that were involved, the military that interacted with these three men and Dave's mum and dad, were in black, head to in black. Yeah. No camouflage gear on. And they were armed. There's got to be more witnesses to this. I mean, so far I've drawn a blank on the social media at Humanby, but that's not to say that something won't occur or I won't find something out. I'm sure I will.
Yeah, and it could be something as relatively innocuous as like a fire engine truck or first responders or people in hazmat gear or that kind of thing in different parts of the countryside, not exactly solely there.
Yeah.
Although that's where the landing seems to have taken place. And there have been reports as part of the lore of ufology that not only have black helicopters and helicopters in general figured prominently in some of the stories, but also there's this notion that some of these helicopters seem to be invisible, that people can hear them quite clearly, but they cannot see them. There's a lot of speculation about that, that they're ET craft that are trying to make themselves sound like helicopters. Yeah. Other people think that it could be advanced stealth or helicopters that have an invisible capability.
James, you've just hit the nail on the head. I mean, once again, we're only doing our own personal take on this, but I believe in some instances, what they were perceiving as helicopters, something might have been impressing on them that they were helicopters. There's not close to helicopters at all. But they're all adamant that whatever it was, the two guys that saw the one being and Dave saw multiple beings outside of this object weren't human. They were 7 to 8 foot tall, Dave's description, very, very thin with overly large heads, but all they could see was the black outline, the silhouette. I mean, he did say, like, they must have had, if they'd got clothing on, it must have been a wetsuit. So we know that it wasn't a helicopter, but Andrew's adamant. He said it was absolutely like looking at a film set. He said it just didn't look real. But I should imagine, James, that's how it would appear. If you're looking
at the surreal aspect, but some of the witnesses at Rennesford Forest described the surreal nature, where Larry Warren talked about how people would take a step and then the shadows of the people would follow in their wake like a split second afterward. That the shadows were out of phase with their own physical movements, just by a fraction.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, who's to say that if this is interdimensional, who's to say that there's not something that's altering reality or putting a bubble around our sphere of reality, our existence, so it can enter and interact with us? That's I don't know who called it the Oz factor. Well, I can't think who it was, but
I think it was Jenny Randall.
So that's the surrealness of the situation, where everything seems to become detached. Everything goes silent.
Yes.
And you're just in an altered state of reality. I don't know whether we're being put into some altered state or whether, as in made to perceive that everything's different, or whether they've actually altered the reality that we perceive as being normal so that they can interact with us. I wish I knew how the mechanisms involved and how the process works, but obviously all I'm doing is picking up people's stories here and running with them, and I just think this one's going to be really interesting.
I think that it's got all the hallmarks of a classic case, and the military must have been involved if they had set up a roadblock somewhere in that region and were accosting and pulling over people that had a direct connection to the experience itself.
Well, that's a bit I struggle with. Why stop his mum and dad and send them back? Unless the roadblock was set up and inadvertently they just got caught up in it. And they'd already been told that they knew the car registration numbers, they knew where they lived, they knew everything about them. All three have said this as well. They knew every detail about them, the military. So they must have known this was going to happen.
Now, just to clarify a point, Paul, the roadblock, was that set up as far as the direction of the roadway was concerned, away from where this incident was taking place or in the direction of the incident?
It depends which way you're coming, I suppose, James, but his parents were driving back to Bridlington.
Okay, so away from the site where all this was going on.
Away from the site, but they were actually taken out of their vehicle and placed in a military vehicle with military personnel inside and frightened. Warned, frightened.
Wow.
And told to get back to the unit and not to come out of the unit. So the military have got to have had prior knowledge that this was happening.
Yes.
Listeners and yourself might have already deduced that I know a little bit more about this that I can't talk about at the moment. It's not groundbreaking. It's not revolutionary. But I don't want to break the trust of one of these men, but there's more to this.
I would think, and I don't want to throw out any fishing lines inadvertently, but at some level, the local constabulary would have been alerted to the fact that something was going on, whether it was simply like a message coming in for them to stay clear of a certain area or to act in some kind of auxiliary role or some kind of support role, but keep away from where the real activity was going on.
You make a good point there, James, and you know that could be true. As I say, there'll be more developments on it if we talk again. Hopefully, I'll have more information for you on this one. You know, but as I say, that's about where I am with this. I mean, I've probably laboured on a bit there, but
no. This, like I said, I mean, when you talk about this case, Paul, I think of other cases like the Guardian case in Canada, where there were a video, you've probably seen the video, showed what was purported to be a landed craft. There was helicopters nearby. There were apparently military forces around this landed craft at night, somewhere in Canada. And there have been a number of stories like this over the years. And the military does try to, if not outright control the situation, at least control the environment, at least control the region where this is going on. They're trying to deny access to more people than necessary, keep the human witnesses to the absolute minimum, right?
Yeah.
Something's going on to keep the people out. It's a denial of access.
Yeah, well, from what I'm told, James, it was the military were aware, and it was not a staged event, but it was at this meeting. There was a meeting. We'll call them the aliens, or the occupants of this object, met with the military. Amongst this, James, I'm told there was a go-between that allowed this to happen.
And was this go-between let's just call him or her a civilian, or was it some
civilian?
Kind
of... A civilian. I need to speak more to these guys before I can start saying more about it, that part of it. There'll still be loads. I'll still gather more information on the story. You know, it's the first time I've ever spoke about this, obviously, because I've not had the story 6 months. And I've just been working away on it. And obviously that was August, but we've got the Rock Anglers sighting in November, which is like 6 miles away, of a landed object. So, you know, all this activity. I think it was 1998, over the North Sea, an object that allegedly was the size of a battleship travelling at something like 27,000 miles an hour. As crazy as that sounds, there'll be a little bit of truth in what I'm saying. I don't know whether there's loads of truth in the story, but it made the national papers at the time. And I think tornadoes were sent to intercept it, which is interesting. And I think that was during these months. And what else is interesting is I have a lifeboat log report in my possession. I put it into the second book when I were writing about a tornado that crashed in, let me just get my facts right, on June the 15th, 1998, just off Farnborough Head. I don't know if it's UFO-related, listeners, but it's a strange story, so I've written about it. June, July, in July, on July the 12th, 1998, fishermen off Bridlington and Hornsey reported seeing a large dark object descend from the sky and land on the surface of the water. Lifeboat were tasked to go and investigate, and I think the Hornsey lifeboat as well. And they searched for several hours but never found anything. And I've got the actual log report. I went into some archives. They were kind enough to let me look in lifeboat station before it all went automated or all became totally different now. I can't get on. But I've got the log. I put a request in and they've let me have the log. So, and that log is actually just called on their system object. Now, it doesn't say UFO. It describes this large dark object. But I think all that kind of information adds to what these guys are telling me, adds to what the rock angler's telling me, and tells us that in 1998, not necessarily when these guys had their sighting, but in 1998, along the eastern North Yorkshire coast, UFO activity, it was absolutely rich. There was a lot of strange things happening. And could what they perceived as the poltergeist, Could that be some kind of residue of the excitement of the area, the build up to what was happening? Could one of them been a little bit sensitive and being able to tap into these things and his own emotional state be creating these things, not even knowingly? I don't think this were poltergeist.
We've known of similar cases, Paul, where people had experiences, even encounters with ETs. And then what happened was, in the days and weeks afterwards, they experienced all kinds of strange phenomena, series of synchronicities. It's not unusual in the lore of alien ET encounters. In the wake of an encounter experiences, in the days and weeks afterwards, it's not unusual for the percipient to suddenly start having like a stream of synchronicities and unusual phenomena and poltergeist type activity. That kind of happened to me when I was younger. I would have objects disappearing and reappearing, and all kinds of strange things were going on around me in the wake of some of these experiences. And many people feel that these experiences are kind of part and parcel to the whole ET contactee, ET abductee lore.
I would agree.
Yeah,
I would agree with that. And I wonder if it's just the phenomena itself that allows other things to access. You know, when these emotional states are occurring, and when the strength of this phenomena is at its peak, I wonder if other paranormal things are able to access and interact. Do you know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. Like a vortex has opened up.
Well, Chris said an interesting thing. He said, we came out to our cars several times. There was huge footprints on the cars. All three men remember it, but it was Chris that told me. And I said, what do you mean? He said, a huge footprint. Not, it's all animal footprints, but huge, as big as people, as big as a man's foot, on the bonnet and up and over the roof.
Oh, wow. He said,
yeah, but no dints. And he said, I came out one night. He was on his own, but he's told me this story. He said, and I'm just locking up, and suddenly I just felt quite scared, you know, the hairs of the back of your neck kind of moment. He says, and I turned around, he says, in the darkness, and there's this huge figure very close to me looking at me. He says, absolutely huge. We're talking, I know 7 or 8 foot tall. I've already said that with the beings. But he's talking that. He says it was monstrous. It was huge. It was almost block shaped. Just, I said, and what? Did you decipher a face or arms? He says, oh, it had arms, but I couldn't tell whether he'd got clothing on or what. He said, I turned around and went, absolutely frightened. He said, and it just walked away into darkness.
Mm.
So you, alongside all of this, and remember that these, we'll call them the poltergeist activity, That started 96, 97, 98. And the build-up was June, July and August. Said, and it just come on that slow that we just accepted it. He said, all three of us were sat in a recovery truck with a customer one day inside the unit. He said, and we never talked about it because people, the experience had taught them that when they talked about it, just like with the auto electrician, they got looked at as lunatics. That car can't start by itself. That car will not. He said, and we sat there in this recovery truck talking about the job and bang, a steel washer hits the side of the unit because we are right crack. So there's some velocity coming from whatever it is. He said, and guy looked, he said, and he didn't say anything. He says, and then another one hit at the other side.
A trickster said, aspect to this as well. He said, it would pay to have some kind of electromagnetic anomaly detectors of some kind brought to that area to try to detect the anomalies.
He says, the guy in the truck, James, he said, what was that? He said, and we just went, oh, it'll be poltergeist. He says, that's how it was with us. He said, we just sort of got accepted it. But as regards the unit, I've been to the unit now, took some photographs. I've been to the compound further down, a little bit further down, which won't expose it, but they break buses up and refurb old buses. They remember it. One of the guys there has been there all that time, and he didn't see anything, but he remembers it. He spoke to me about it and said, oh, yeah, he said, and I know the guys in question. He said, yeah, they told us about it at the beginning. He says, I do remember this. I've rang the people who now own the unit to inquire if they've ever had any unusual experiences or anything strange has occurred, thinking, like I've spoke about in the books, James, location is location key.
Yes.
Which it is in a lot of instances, you know. I mean, the stuff that happens around Bempton, the stuff that happens in other key places around the world, Rendlesham, Skinwalker, we can't deny that location is not key. But in this instance, I think person was key, as an individual was responsible. Not responsible for evoking a UFO or evoking the experiences, but one person is part of this. Cut back briefly, the guys at the unit now have never experienced anything. One man who works for them remembers it, but they've not had any strange experiences, or that's what they tell me, within the unit that they now work. And that, so that we've got like a 22-year period or whatever it is between, and nothing's happened. Sorry, James, you were saying.
That's quite all right. That's a very good point. And either nothing has happened there, they haven't been aware of anything, or they're keeping mum about it. I mean,
It could be a matter of keeping mum about it. I did think that because last thing I want is me going around intruding on work time, you know, and stirring things up. And the people who are employers there, they might not want this. I left them for a week. They said they were going to ask the questions, and I rang them back a week later as they asked me, and there were just one person who remembered it, but they weren't willing to tell me who it was or if he would speak to me. So, I mean, the grave marker got taken away and got buried, as I'm told, in Humanby Church, the grounds of Humanby Church. Well, I have contacted the vicar there, and he's looking into it to find out. I would have thought that there's going to be a date for that. Do they call it interned? When that grave marker was placed in the churchyard, there's got to be some documentation. So hopefully we can get a closer date. They're just telling me August 1998. I mean, it might be beginning of August, it might be 1997, but we've got August 1998 based on what these three men are saying. And yeah, that's where we are with that story at the moment.
Wow, it's been a fascinating first segment, Paul, and thank you for sharing all that. We reached the end of the first segment with Paul Sinclair. Paul, can you give our listeners your website again?
Yeah, it's truthproof.webs.com, and I'm a little bit embarrassed saying website because me and social media are pretty useless. Anybody who's interested in the books, they're available on Amazon, and you can buy them via the website, because there's a PayPal link there. But as I say, read the reviews for books. Don't take my word for it. And if you like them, send me a message. I don't mind signing them. And thank you very much, James.
Well, we've reached the end of a fascinating first segment with Paul Sinclair. This is the Cosmic Switchboard Show. If you like what we do, if you believe in what we do, please go to thecosmicswitchboard.com, sign up and become a member, and we'll see you at the top of the next segment.